Hey everyone, and welcome to How Did I Get Here? A podcast where we talk to lawyers to learn about their career and the steps they took to get there. This episode is the season one finale, and we're doing it a little differently from our past episodes. On this episode, we have Sonia Khan, a senior advisor at the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs at the U.S. Department of Labor, and president of Mubani, and myself, Shabir Chaudhary, senior counsel at Guardian and vice president of Mubani. Here's our conversation. Sonia, as you know, typically on this show, we interview accomplished attorneys in the public and private spaces and have even interviewed a U.S. magistrate judge. And they talk about their careers and all the great things that they did to get to where they are. But on this episode, we thought it'd be great for our listeners to hear about what happens when life doesn't go exactly as you hoped, using our own personal experiences as examples. Spoiler alert, the further you get from law school, the more it feels like it all worked out the way it was supposed to. Sonia, you know, we both graduated right after kind of the 2008 recession. What was your experience graduating from law school and getting your first job?
Yeah, no, you're so right. I remember you and I met in like 2012, right? So we had just come out of that dark time, I guess you could say.
Kind of, I don't know if out of it is the right word, but you know, we were on the better side of it, but still in the thick of it, I think.
Yeah, no, you're right. So I graduated in 2009. So I remember I was taking the bar that July and, you know, I felt like so accomplished. I was all set. I was done. I was looking for a job. I did not graduate law school with a job. So I had to look. And then I like distinctly remember that September that like the Lehman Brothers fell. And there were just like all the news coverage was everyone with like boxes coming out of these big buildings and like, you know, just looking completely demoralized. And then after that, how there was just this wave into, you know, the legal sector. And it was the situation where even when I graduated, associates that had offers were either rescinded or deferred. And so I think that was, I actually am misremembering. I think that was September 2008. And then I graduated in May 2009. And so I graduated in this moment where the legal market was saturated with attorneys who were looking for jobs from 2008, the 2008 year, and 2009. And yeah. And the other crazy thing is I didn't even want to be a practicing lawyer. I was totally one of those people that went to law school to try to, you know, get in a policy position and do international development, human rights work. But then what so happened was that a lot of the associates and attorneys who were deferred from law firms were going into a lot of public sector work and a lot of international human rights and development work because of a lot of the law firms kind of set up these programs that said, okay, you can go into this for a year. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so that left someone like me who didn't go to like, you know, a top 10 law school, did pass the bar on the first try, but was not like a top law student either. And wasn't really interested in practicing, really in a very precarious position when it came to my job search. And so what I did was I honestly just went to my network that I grew up with, you know, like the Pakistani community, the Muslim community, the other communities that I grew up, you know, I grew up in like upstate New York, and just said like, hey, I'm looking for a job. Do you have any leads? Do you have any strategies, et cetera, et cetera? And there was one person who's really actually stayed a mentor throughout my career who was able to kind of just like look at my resume, put in edits, and mentioned that at the New York AG's office, which is, you know, where I ended up, that they had this volunteer attorney program. And so I went through that process. That person was very helpful and like guided me through. And I got that position, which meant that I essentially had the same duties as a regular attorney, but was not being paid. And I worked in the Albany office and lived with my parents after, you know, after law school. I'm so grateful to be able to do that. It was a really special time, but it was also like, I mean, without a support system, I don't know how I would have gone through those sorts of moments to at least like practice in the law. And I remember distinctly having a conversation with my parents being like, okay, so through this situation I'm in, you know, I'm not going to have health insurance provided through my work. So like, that means my parents would have to cover it. But at that time, the big news was that like Starbucks, if you worked at Starbucks, like they would give you health insurance. So I remember telling my parents, like, I'll work at Starbucks to get health insurance. And then also like maybe work part-time at the AG's office. Then I can, you know, split my time, get the health insurance. You don't have to pay for it, but then at least get experience. And my parents, which I give them a lot of credit for, like had this foresight to say, just, it's okay. Like, it's okay. Just focus right now on developing your skills, because that's going to be the thing that will get you your next thing. Like that will get you a job if you can just show that you have the skills. And that's how I kind of weathered through it.
Yeah, no, your parents are great advice there. And I'm sure that's, you know, advice you give to law students, young attorneys now, and skills are really important. So I graduated a year after you did. And so, you know, the trickle down you explained just kept trickling down, right? So my 2L, you know, this summer, your 2L summer, you summer associated firm, most people, they cut all the programs. So the sizes got smaller. Some firms didn't have it. There wasn't, you know, that whole, you know, law school is this feeder program where summer, your 2L summer job is the place where you work. And then you kind of get that, that gets you off the ground, right? And when your 2L summer job doesn't come through, you know, you're really, you're kind of scrambling to figure out, what am I going to do? So you're really planning for 2 years, trying to figure out, what am I going to do after I graduate law school? Because you, you know, you interview between 1L and 2L, I think, for your post that summer job. I wasn't. So no, I went through the interview process, didn't work. Then they have like the winter interview process, didn't get an offer. And then, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do over the summer. And then I think, I want to say like mid to late spring, I get a call from, or an email from, some division in Homeland Security saying, hey, you applied for an internship. We want to, you know, interview you. And I was like, oh yes, please. Thank you. Interviewed, spent the summer in DC working at CIS. Kind of in some policy shop doing some work. It worked out. I had a summer job. It paid. It was interesting. I made some DC connections, but it wasn't something that led to a job offer, right? It was just a internship. Process starts over. I must have sent so many job applications, cold emails, just old school, just writing letters to, you know, finding, like go to firms' websites, like mid, small, large, finding people who went to your college, to your law school, who was on the same extracurriculars you're on, to see if you can have some link, just to send a letter to be like, hey, saw you have an opening. More often than not, didn't hear back. And then, you know, 3L's approaching, or the end of 3L's approaching. And I just thought, I haven't thought about this in a while, but I remember I went on an interview with this firm, first round, second round, final round, did it. And then just never heard from them. And this goes to your point about like, there was just so many applicants. There's so many lawyers looking for jobs that the employers just had an abundance of applicants and they would just ghost. And I remember like calling them, emailing them, like, hey, what happened to my application? I went to find them. Like, never heard back from anybody. But eventually, you know, I ended up doing a clerkship, which I accidentally kind of stumbled into. The judge that I clerked for was appointed off cycle. I guess not even off cycle, just appointed late. And I didn't have a job for after law school until like October after I graduated, because she was appointed in like September or October. But it was like a 1 year clerkship. It was just another stopgap until you figure out what's next. So even though you get it, you're like, okay, sigh of relief. Have a job, but what's next? And it's just been this constant cycle of like, you know, you kind of get these band-aids to the solution and you're just trying to figure out, where do I go next? How does this work? What, you know, and I wasn't like, I'm a kid from Queens. I was in Jersey, admitted, like that wasn't gonna happen. I never did it. So I did a clerkship out in Jersey State Court, and it was, you know, the judge was like, so you're not going to get admitted? And I was like, I don't know, I guess I can. But, you know, she tried to like introduce me to her like partner, her friends who are partners at firms, but they were all Jersey based firms. So they're like, they're not going to hire you. So, you know, I sat for the, I had to study that year for the Jersey bar. And I took it, not in February, I guess I took it that summer. I did not pass. But I had a job. I had a New York job at that point. So I was like, okay, I don't feel so bad about this. But it was really hard to study after you finish college. Because, you know, the whole thing with the bar exam was like, this is the last test you're ever going to have to take in your life. And you go ham on that. And then you're just like, okay, I never have to study again. Like, read briefs, sure. But study for an exam is just like a whole different muscle, and I could not get myself to focus on that. So not Jersey admitted still, but I think it all worked out.
So where'd you end up in New York?
Yeah, I was at the court counsel's office, the city law department.
That's where you were when we met, I think.
Yeah, so that's where, great experience. You know, I originally wanted to, you go to law school, it's a lot of money, a lot of loans, and you think, okay, I need a big firm job so I can pay down some of that debt. And that's usually like, you know, not, you get really great experience and training at a firm too, but it also helps explain the cost of law school. When that didn't work out, you know, I ended up in this government job, which obviously pays nowhere near the same amount. But in hindsight, the experience I got there was huge. And it helped really, to your point earlier about skills, really helped me develop core skills that I think helped me later in my career to kind of distinguish myself from my peers who spent time at a law firm developing their early set of skills, which is very different than the kind of skills that you'll develop when you're at government, going to court, doing depositions, doing trials, things like that.
I ended up getting the volunteer attorney position only after I was sworn in. So I started working in January after I had graduated. But the thing was that March, because I was in the Appeals and Opinions Bureau, you know, I was working with like assistant solicitor generals and solicitor general, Barbara Underwood at that time. And yeah, I was getting like very substantive, like legal research assignments, writing assignments, even to the point where, they gave me an appellate argument, like a state appellate argument at the third department, I remember, with no opposing counsel, thankfully, but I was able to do it. And I was like, oh, wow. You know, I'm in the first year of my career. I did not take lit skills. I didn't do any of the conventional legal courses because I did not think I was going to be a real lawyer, like a real, in air quotes there, but I got that like real hard, like lit skills, research, writing, training in that year at the Appeals and Opinions Bureau, and then was able to kind of parlay that volunteer position into a full-time position in the litigation bureau at the office, which I did for four or five years, and was also core skills, you know, skills development or whatever. But I was going to say just one small anecdote on that appellate argument. I remember I would go and just watch the appellate arguments before I did one. And I remember there was like this attorney that walked in with like, you know, an oversized suit, like everything falling out of the briefcase, like all the things, you know, it was like a show. And he gets up there, and then he has like his opposing counsel. The opposing counsel is like ripping him to shreds. And I see like out of the corner of my eye, this pink, like hot pink thing kind of like flapping, like in, you know, in like the periphery. And I look over, and he was like feverishly writing on his notebook, like with a pen that had a troll on the top of like the pen. You know, do you remember trolls? Like when we were little. And it was like hot. It was like a troll with hot pink hair. And that is what he was like writing with, like in appellate court. And that was like a moment for me when I was like, okay, I could do this. Like I could figure it out.
It's funny that you say that though. Like part of earlier in my career, I got so much rejection, right, from jobs and just dreams not being met, that I questioned, was I supposed to be a lawyer? Is this what I'm supposed to? Am I not good at it? And it's funny that, you know, that anecdote is funny, but I think it came from a place of when you're not living kind of what you expected post-law school, you start questioning all the decisions you made. But I look at that kid that graduated school like 10 plus years ago, and it's like, it doesn't mean anything. Like, those rejections are not a reflection of your ability to be a lawyer or anything like that.
100%. I think they may even make you a better lawyer, because, you know, there's a lot about the practice of law, even if it's transactional or litigation, or even like policy, right? You have to articulate your position, and you have to understand others' positions, and you have to know how to, like, you know, find the middle point, or you need to know when to fight. Like, all of these like instinctual things, they come from a lot of those moments. And I totally feel you.
I mean, those experiences help. And I'm sure we'll get to this as we talk about the kind of later part of our careers, but those non-substantive skills, right? I mean, your softer skills and judgment and resilience, you know, those are shaped by the experiences you go through. So I think you're right. Like, I think, especially in the in-house setting, I think resilience is a really key skill, being able to bounce back and not be deterred or not kind of get discouraged by hitting brick walls, and figuring out how to, you know, adjust, adapt, figure out a new plan of attack or something like that. How did you get from your volunteer position to the permanent position and then ultimately to civil rights?
I guess from the volunteer position to the permanent position, you know, I was just putting a lot of feelers out within the AG's office, just being like, okay, like, I'm interested. And a position just opened up in the litigation bureau. And so I was able to kind of like slot into that and start getting paid. And so that was nice. And even in that role, like, you know, it was very interesting work because it was on the defensive side. So, you know, the AG's office is split into the affirmative side, and a lot of law enforcement agencies are split into like the affirmative side where you prosecute and the defensive side where you're defending the entity. So we would be defending like certain state agencies. And I was in court probably 3 days a week, a lot of motion practice, a lot of that sort of stuff. It wasn't necessarily, again, at that time, I was not thinking that this is like what I want to be doing. Okay. But I was doing it. And so what I did was,
but did you know what you wanted to be doing?
Well, I thought I did. I thought I knew, right? I was still thinking, okay, I want to go into international development. But I think what definitely presented itself there was this like dichotomy of international development work and domestic civil rights work. And seeing that there is, even though they're like two separate tracks, there's overlap in a way. And I remember like one piece of feedback that I had gotten from someone was, you know, if you think that you want to go to like other countries and present yourself as a lawyer, like you should probably practice in the country that you're from before you know, there's a little bit of a colonial mindset there that you need to like get yourself out of if like you think that's, you know. And now looking back, I mean, I have a much different view on the work that I wanted to do. I ended up going into more of a domestic civil rights role, but I really ended up seeking that out outside of work. So work was like, I'm getting my skills. Outside of work, I was doing like the things I cared about. So that was like, you know, within certain bar associations, including Mobani. It was probably one of the seminal things was creating like a CLE with a few people like within the AG's office and outside of the AG's office on the basics of Islam and like relevant emerging legal trends, because it became clear that that was like an area of like cultural competency inequity that I think, you know, I saw like a gap and I wanted to help fill. And so I ended up putting this CLE together, and, you know, we ended up giving it to, I think, all New York state agencies. And then we also held it at the New York City Bar. And I think the one that we held with the New York City Bar, we did in co-sponsorship with Mobani. But the point being that doing the CLE and having like that momentum outside of work, even though it was kind of like work adjacent, was kind of what parlayed me into more domestic civil rights work, you know, at the time. And I started working with the Civil Rights Bureau within the AG's office on specific projects. And then when an opening came up, I applied and I was able to get that position. And I got that position in July 2016.
All right, so it took 6 years after law school.
You know, to that point though, I think one of the biggest selling points for like my supervisors in the Civil Rights Bureau was the fact that I was coming with a litigation background. And so it was like my skills, even though like my interests and like these other things, they were important. The other bucket of like skills that I had or had developed was like equally, if not more important.
They looked at your work experience, but they also kind of looked at the stuff you're doing in addition to work that was in the sphere of relevancy to civil rights work and helped you develop relationships and kind of some experience with it to show that you had an interest in it. So it's kind of one of those things, right? Like you just kind of raise your hand for opportunities and you never know where it's going to lead.
You got to fill your soul. Like that's really what it is. You know, you're like, if you feel like you're, you know, you're not getting that from work, which is probably true for the majority of people. You know, you got to find it somewhere else. And it doesn't have to be that, but you know, whatever it is. But you, like, I know you were at Corp Counsel for how long? And then like, how did you go from the public sector to like the private?
Yes.
That's an interesting move.
So I was at Corp Counsel for 3 years, and I think I was always trying to kind of bring my path back to where I thought it should be, right? I was always trying to, I think since I graduated law school, I think I looked at my career as something like a path that, it wasn't on the path that I wanted to be, and I was trying to find a road back, right? And sometimes, you know, it was kind of like a parallel path, and I was looking to find that road that's going to kind of bring me into kind of that, the original path that I wanted. And when I entered law school, I guess what I wanted to do was be in-house at a firm. I wanted to be in-house. And I always liked the idea of just having one client, doing work for one person or one entity, and kind of working for a company. That appealed to me. And I knew you don't graduate law school and you go in-house, right? So I knew the path was law school, firm, transition to a client. That's usually how it works, right? Obviously, when the firm path didn't happen, and I was on this public sector path, it was hard to figure out how am I going to go from here to in-house. So I knew I always needed to figure out a way to get back into a firm. So while I was at Corp Counsel, I was always thinking about, okay, what are the skills, what are the relationships I need to develop to find that jump? And then towards the end of my 3 years, you know, there's a firm that I knew somebody was, they were looking for an associate, and she kind of put in a good word for me, helped me with the application process. I interviewed, got the job. And then I was at a firm doing pretty much kind of what I was doing at Corp Counsel, but doing it on the private side and defense work. But I was only there for, I think, 16 months. It was a very short stint, because from there, I then made the jump to MetLife, which was in-house, which is kind of what I wanted to do. And that just stumbled into accidentally, right? I'm always looking on job boards. You know, I get like emails from companies or recruiters and things like that. And I'm always curious what the market is and what firms are looking for, what kind of skills that they're looking for, and try to develop those skills for roles that I thought were interesting. So then
I have to interrupt you. Have to interrupt you there, because it's not just job boards where you have that skill. You have that skill on LinkedIn. You are like, I don't know anyone who uses LinkedIn as well as you. And that's a whole other podcast episode, but I have to give you that shine.
I don't know if I use it well. I use it and I read it a lot. But for the MetLife position, I've been involved with Mubani kind of passingly at that point, right? I was a law student, I'd go to some events, met some people, and then over time, and you know, continue to go to networking events and develop relationships with people. And one of the somebody I met through Mubani used to work at MetLife, and I had called him and said, hey, there's a job posting. I don't really know what the position is. So I spoke to him and he kind of described the role, and he said, hey, I know that person. Send me a resume. I'll send it along. And that made the difference, right? Like how many jobs I've applied to just through the application portal most of them have, 99% of them have gone unresponded to. But when you have somebody deliver that for you and it comes with the word of, oh yeah, I know this person, you know, worked with them on bar association things, and you know, I know the person's like a hard worker, whatever that person may have said about me, that made the difference. I got an interview. I interviewed well. It was a fast interview process. Like, it was 4 weeks, four rounds, one every week. I'd have to like leave work, go to MetLife, go interview, meet people, and they just kind of cycled through it. And then I got the job. That's kind of how I transitioned. And part of that was looking at the skills. I knew that my experience, the work that I was doing at Corp Counsel or at the defense firm, was different than all the other applicants, or the majority of the applicants, or majority of the people that MetLife was going to hire. But I need to figure out, how am I going to set myself apart? And my whole thing was, at Corp Counsel, I was a litigator. I did trials. I did like 200 depositions, and that's on my resume. Like, I know how to read a case, assess like the risk, and I know how to manage it and take ownership over something. And that's kind of the story that I painted for myself in the application process. Obviously, having somebody pass my resume along helps, but that only gets you so far. I feel like that gets you to the door. You have to carry it home.
100%. You have to make the interview process happen. But your point about management and ownership of things, like that, those two things, I think, are the things that like really set somebody apart. You know, like when people are working in different places, like what makes someone have the ability to manage up and manage across is someone who's like, you know, for lack of a better term, just like is able to kind of like handle what they have in front of them on their own. And then I think people start to respect you, and they start to respect your opinion, and they start to come to you for advice and stuff like that. So it's such a key trait and skill that it's so good you developed.
Yeah. And also with that, you know, networking, right? Really important. And that's that relationship that helped get me, you know, that first, with the MetLife connection, probably 10 years in the making, right? Like, I met the guy who was in law school, 7-8 years. So, you know, networking is one of those things that you got to put time in, and it's somewhat organic. You have to continue to develop that relationship. And it's not this whole, oh, I met somebody at an event and now they're going to pass along. It's not like a one and done. It does take time. Networking is key, and I think we're going to talk about that especially as you get further in your career, how that is really integral to setting you apart and furthering your career progress.
For sure. I think networking is foundational. Like, it's a foundational thing. But it's like reminding me of something that I know you and I have talked about like a number of times, and you know, since we've known each other, which is how there are different theories when it comes to like your career, right? So some people are like, my work will speak for itself. So I'm just going to do really good work, and that is going to set me apart, and that's going to be the thing that is going to help me move forward. And there are other people who do like good work, but they are able to connect with people, and they're able to like have, you know, deeper relationships. And I know you and I we've seen this, and without throwing any shade to anyone, we've seen this, and we've seen sometimes how like, you know, the people who are just really, really good at networking end up in positions that like seem like leaps and bounds ahead sometimes of the people who are just doing really good work. And I think I don't know what the lesson is. I think, you know, we're still trying to figure it out. It's just been an observation that we've had. But I know for me, the approach that I've tried to take is to always prioritize like the quality of my work over everything. And then within that, like weave in the relationship development in an authentic manner, right? I mean, I think, and that's what you're saying, but I just wanted to tease that out because it's something you and I
are right. Always yeah, and I think it's important. It's not an either or scenario, right? I think your work needs to be good, but the people you know always makes a huge difference. And, you know, when I remember I had a mentor who once told me, you're not going to succeed in-house if you're one of those people who just puts their head down and does a good job. You will become a subject matter expert and you may be able to do your job really well, but that isn't enough to grow your career. Like, and as you, you know, there's this turning point in your career, which nobody really tells you when it is, but it's no longer, you know, early in your career, you're relied upon developing your skills and being an asset to support people to do their job. And then all of a sudden you're expected to be a skills leader, but also, you know, show that you can take ownership and drive things and then start developing relationships so you can spread your wings, right? And I think nobody tells you when you're supposed to flip that switch. Because if you try to do it too early, it's like, hey, young buck, like, not yet, right? Like, you got to get some trials under your belt. And then if you don't flip the switch, then it's like, well, you're just a subject matter expert. Nobody sees you as a thought leader, right? Like, so there's a point in your career you have to figure out when, like, you know, early in your career, really important to develop those skills. But then at some point, maybe 5, 6, 7 years out of law school, or earlier, maybe even 4, you start trying to figure out, okay, how do I now take that next step of leveraging the skills that I have to turn it into something more?
Even the term thought leader, like, that was not something that was, I mean, probably in any of our vocabularies within the last like three, or prior to the last like 3 to 4 years. But I mean, the concept definitely, you know, was around. But even, I think that's the thing. It's like, in my mind, I was just trying to like prove that I was even like worthy to be in some of these spaces. So I was trying to just do really good work. Like, the idea that I would try to lead anything was like so far from the way I was thinking. And yeah, that switch, like, it needs to happen like at some point. And then it happens and you're like, really? You sure? I don't know. Is that like something that I can do, you know? And then you go from there. But it is definitely something that I wish was more, I'll say this. I think it's something that really good mentorship, really good, like, affirmative sort of like action steps to take, like, when you're a younger attorney, is to like seek out those sorts of resources to learn, like, those softer, I guess, would you call them softer skills, or like strategy, realizing and thinking about how to hone those skills alongside these like research writing and, like, you know, the quality of your work. It's really hard.
Yeah, no, I think you were kind of talking about that, but mentors and sponsors really help you figure out when that is, right? So if you're talking about our careers and using mine as an example, right? Like, early on, work was important, developing those skills, trying to get myself to a place where I wanted to be, and developing, you know, early in your career, you have mentors. It's really hard to get sponsors. And then you get mentors who give you advice, who kind of guide you and say, these are things you should think about. You maybe want to do this, or introduce you to other people. And you start doing that to build your network and build your connections. And then at a certain point in your career, then you start developing or finding sponsors. And these are people usually within your organization, sometimes outside, who are looking out for you, right? And trying to find you the opportunities. And what I found, you know, I want to say this is like 5, 6, 7 year mark, I started having conversations with people like about, this is where I want my career to go. And their response would be like, okay, well, these are the things that you need to do. And then, you know, I'm like, okay, great. Where do I get those opportunities? And having that conversation, it put it on their radar. Oh, Shabir is interested in this. Let me keep that in mind. When this opportunity presents itself, I'll try to get him on this project, or try to get him this assignment, or I'll talk to this person to see, hey, are you guys short staffed? Because I have somebody who may be able to do some extra work. And it was extra work. I was expected to do my job and other stuff. But if I wanted to grow and develop these relationships with people, I would have to raise my hand for other opportunities. But it would give me the opportunity to learn, and also an opportunity to shine, and then get a broader network from there, right? So you're always thinking about these things. It never stops. And sometimes it is exhausting, right? And sometimes it's okay to take a break and say, you know what? I'm going to focus on me right now.
Oh, that is totally okay. Yes. No, but these are all, you made so many good points. Just to tease this out, I think first, this point about taking initiative. The taking initiative part is so important, but as important as the executing part. So if you are raising your hand to take initiative, you have to execute. You know what I mean? Because that's the relationship development in certain contexts. And so I think that's like such an important point. And your point about, yeah, like you're able to kind of go and talk to people when you're confused. That's exactly what my default has been. Like, I'm confused. I call up like two or three people, maybe even you, and then we talk it out and it helps, right? And so it's a really good point to kind of say that you can seek out mentors when you're confused too. You just have to kind of be able to say what you're confused about.
Two things about that. I mean, the first part, reaching out to people when you're confused, and that's the premise of this series. It's trying to get voices and stories out to people that you may not know the people that we're interviewing, but at least you can hear the story to help shape the way you think about your career or how, you know, whatever obstacles or decisions you're faced with. And then the other part is what I found when you talk about the things that you want, I know, you know, people say put it out in the universe and it happens, but it does, because when you talk about the things you want, people then understand, oh, this is something that somebody's interested in. And people generally want to help as long as it's like an attainable goal. Like if you're a lawyer and you want to become a surgeon, I think that's a separate problem, right? Like that's not something easy networking can solve. But if you want to be a lawyer and you want to continue in some related field and you put it out in the universe, people will introduce you to people like, oh, I know somebody who did something similar. You should talk to them, right? And that's really how the story starts, is by first kind of breathing it into air.
You know, the point you made at the beginning where you said, the spoiler alert, that the farther you get, it feels like it makes more and more sense. I mean, I know I look at you and I, so we've kind of known each other, right, through this whole process, essentially, like with the trajectory we just talked about. And that statement could not be more true. I would not have necessarily myself chosen these paths, right? But like, I'm so glad that I took them, because I think that to start your career when like it feels like everything is breaking right around you, like the economy and like the field and like all the things, and you start with a level of hustle, basically, that it becomes, I think, naturally ingrained in you. And I'm not trying to say you should always be, you know, operating on that level, but I think it has definitely taught me something that even like in the current point in my career, I'm still trying to be like, okay, what's next? Like, what's more? Like, how can I get the most out of this experience? Like, what, it's just trained me to think that way. And it's just been, you know, it's been great to see how it's all played out. Like, you're in an amazing position and I'm still figuring it out, but we are, you know, we're getting this done. And we had the opportunity also to work on Mobani very closely for the last 2 years and really take what we saw, I think, outside of work, like all these little things, and try to infuse that into this organization alongside all the other amazing members of the board, of course.
You know, your term is ending, my term is ending, who on the Mobani board. What did you think is the importance of bar associations or relevance of bar associations for career development?
Particularly if you are part of an affinity group, a bar association is like a standalone network that can just bring so much value. But just like anything else, it's like what you put in it is what you get out of it. And I want to say, like, very clearly, so specifically, like in the context of the Muslim bar associations, right? I mean, I know personally for me, you know, I haven't always been comfortable in all Muslim institutions or Muslim settings. I do think that there are a lot of like systemic issues, systemic racism, you know, just across the board, like a lot of issues. That being said, I think it's still, I was still attracted to a role like this and working with this bar association with a lot of like-minded people to really like break open, to the extent that we could, a lot of those like structures, but then also really get to know people who are also trying to navigate their careers most of whom don't necessarily have people like to look up to. But I think with those kind of like two principles or pillars in mind, it's just been so beneficial to be part of Mobani. And it's expanded the network, you know, just from a professional standpoint, definitely expanded the network, then also allowed me to kind of see just the various paths there are within the legal field and give back to the community, you know?
You know, for me, going back to Mobani, like one of my things that was really important and was career development, trying to put together programming and things like that. So I felt like it was a way of giving back, but also just seeing how it's helpful to law students and being a resource. And it's honestly, it's something fun to do outside of work.
And I hope people know that they can definitely reach out for sure.
Last question. I've ended every single one this way. And even though this is a different conversation, still going to end it this way. What's one piece of advice you have for our listeners?
I would say, don't take yourselves too seriously. And I say that because I think, particularly in the law, there's a lot of that, you know, whether it's from law school all the way to like 20 years out of your career, just like do what you can, take the breaks you need, find balance. And like, you know, we all make mistakes and it's okay. Like you'll get up. It's fine. So that's what I would say. Don't take yourself too seriously. What would your piece of advice be?
To speak your heart and just, like we said earlier, put it out into existence, what you want, what you're thinking. It'll help make it come true because it'll help you contextualize what you want. It'll give you thought partners to talk this through, you know, raise your hand for opportunities. Just anything where you put yourself first and kind of put yourself out there. It may feel scary. You may feel, I'm not qualified, I'm not able, I don't have the skills or whatever reason, but those are just your own inner demons in your voice. Let somebody else tell you that you're not ready for this job or this opportunity and have them explain why, and then get those skills, right? And until you get yourself out of that shell, you're really competing only with yourself. So you won't know what everybody else really thinks or needs. Thanks for joining us today, Sonia. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.